You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated...
It is Wednesday, September 28th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is The Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the show, me talking. War on Occupy Wall Street, numbers beginning to grow. A look back on one of the stories about the Iran hostages that nobody's talking about, except for, of course, Glenn Greenwald. An update on food safety and just why Republicans are so reprehensible. And 45 minutes analyzing Chris Christie's speech. Will he or won't he? As to the question of will Chris Christie run or not, I don't give a...
Hey, what happened?
The rumors of the EPA spending hundreds of billions of dollars, employing tens of thousands of new employees to keep us safe, turn out to be a complete joke. And... News Corp, still on the hot seat. That's not going to go away, folks. You may not hear much about it, but it's not going to go away. And, of course, on the better half, your IMs and phone calls. Last night, I was on the on Countdown with Keith Olbermann, and we will include that clip on the members-only podcast, the better half of the show. I mean, you get double the content. That's why I ask you every day in such a whiny and pleading way, become a member of the Majority Report. You know what I noticed is that when I don't ask, you don't sign up. So please, folks, your support is crucial to keeping this show alive. I don't know how else to put that. And on top of that, you get twice as much content. You don't have to listen to all of it. You can skip through it. And we will endeavor to do a better job in the coming months of making it clear exactly what's discussed there so you can skip around a little bit more, make it a little bit more convenient. For instance, tomorrow it will be Rosh Hashanah, which is the Jewish New Year. As such, in observance of this high holiday for Jewy types like myself, tomorrow will be a pre-recorded program which will feature for you cheapies an interview I did with Bill Lozonik on the whole notion. What's really behind this whole thing of repatriating corporate profits? And also, additional material from yesterday, an attorney who is doing pro bono work down there, very interesting guy, down in Occupy Wall Street, talks about essentially movement law and protest law. And for those of you who... our Majority Report members, I will also tack on a really amazing conversation I had with Bobby Kennedy about the death penalty, where he talks about it from the perspective – this is really fascinating stuff. He talks about the death penalty from the perspective of having his father murdered, assassinated, Robert Kennedy Sr., of course, and his family's response to that, and having two members of his family, his cousin, Michael Skagel, convicted of murder, which it's just a fascinating conversation because I remember that story, I guess about 10 years ago. Michael Skagel, a Kennedy cousin who was convicted, I believe it was in 2001, of a crime that he supposedly committed 20 years earlier, maybe more, when he was 15. He was convicted of the murder of a girl who lived down the street from him. Bobby Kennedy has written in the past, won an award, I guess, for a piece he wrote for The Atlantic back in 2002, 2003, outlining why he felt Skagel was innocent. He goes into great depth about this. You know, at the time, I assumed, well, it's a Kennedy cousin. You know, how can a guy like that get a bad lawyer? He must be guilty. And, you know, one of the things that you become aware of, there are 100, like literally 100 Kennedy cousins. And, you know, they've been in politics for a long time. There isn't the same, I think, amount of money and the same type of pull. And according to Bobby, he had a very bad lawyer. And Bobby really outlines why Skagel, he believes, is innocent. Talks about it in the context of prosecutors wanting to get the death penalty for Skagel at that time and how innocent people can be sent to jail. He also recounts the story of his brother-in-law, who was one of the Guilford Four, which were Irish nationals accused of committing an IRA bombing, imprisoned for years, and later it was found out that, in fact, they weren't guilty. Other people confessed to it. Bobby's cousin had a gun put in his mouth to convince him to sign a confession, and I guess it was the basis of a movie I haven't seen, but I'm going to go out and see it, In the Name of the Father. It's a fascinating conversation, and I call it a conversation, but in fact, it's really what's fascinating is Bobby. I just sat in the midst of this conversation, sort of my mouth agape, just can't believing I'm having this opportunity. I don't know if Bobby Kennedy has ever spoken as much about the assassination of his father, at least what happened afterwards, in public before. I'm not aware of it. So for members, you will enjoy that that extra bonus material. And then we'll be back live Friday from an undisclosed post-Rosh Hashanah location, where I will be shaking the lulav and holding the etrog. For you Jews, you know what that is. If you're not Jewish, it's really irrelevant and not terribly interesting. So yesterday we broadcast from Occupy Wall Street. I want to apologize for the second half of the quality of the audio of that podcast. What happened is the scene down there, and we started broadcasting early because we were afraid of rain. And so we started broadcasting closer to about 10:40, and then we looped back that podcast. So you may have heard that or not, but if you were listening live, nevertheless, the scene down there, it's fascinating. We were basically sitting, you know, in this park. They are occupying this park because it's open 24 hours. And it is a quasi-public private space owned by the city, but upgraded by a private developer as part of the deal of them upgrading, you know, getting, I guess, probably city property that they built upon years ago. And in the middle of this park are stone benches. And that is where stone benches that sort of make almost like a square in the center of the park, if you will. not too large, probably 30 by 30 dimensions. And this is where the media center is. I guess that's where the power is. I don't know if they're doing it by generators. I didn't hear any generators. And so it is completely decentralized in terms of who you speak to there. So we just came into that area, and I asked somebody, look, Sam Cedar from the Majority Report doing a live broadcast. Can we get some power? And the guy was like, yeah, it's power right over there. And so we got on to one of the power strips. We plugged in. We're using a mini mixer and microphones and broadcasting literally. Couldn't get on the Wi-Fi, so it was broadcasting through my iPhone, through 3G. And things were going great. We didn't have exactly any ability to monitor it. And certainly at the time, we had no one monitoring it because most people didn't know we were live. And at one point in the mayhem in the media center, our power went down. The broadcast unit, which is my iPhone, continued to broadcast, but the mixer was not feeding into it. When we got the power app, I checked the meters on the broadcast unit, the iPhone, fine. On my mixer, fine. But what I think happened, Matt and I figured out yesterday afternoon, was the iPhone defaulted to its own microphone. And even though the power came back on with the mixer, it remained on that microphone. So you get a lot more ambient sound, and you can, in some instances, barely hear what we're talking about. So we had to jerry-rig some of the sound, so I apologize for that. And the quality of the audio from the interview with the lawyer is not great, but it's an interesting interview. I think you might enjoy it. And you also get a sense of what it was like down there. Now, while I was down there, Susan Sarandon was basically just giving interviews, talking about encouraging people. Later in the evening, our ace stringer in the park, Don't Be a Putz, who we interviewed yesterday, and it was a real thrill for me to meet a longtime IMer of this show, was giving me updates. And of course, we have the live stream on the front page of majority.fm. By the time the General Assembly, the second General Assembly, they have two of them every day, started, I believe it was about 7 p.m., there was about triple the amount of people who were there. And in fact, possibly even more. I mean, I saw the video of it. I got the reports from Don't Be a Putz. It was about 600 people there. And Cornel West, Amy Goodman was down there. We saw, while we were there, Jumaane Williams, a city councilman from Brooklyn. And so it is growing. There is no doubt. I can only imagine what's going to happen this weekend, particularly if the weather is good. You know, obviously, when the weather is tough, it's tough. But it was very impressive to me. And I want to get to more about how it's being reported and not reported and the scorn they're getting. But I want to call your attention to this piece in the New York Times, which weirdly omits Occupy Wall Street. But it talks about the growing number of protests around the world. Now, this is not going to come as a surprise to you, even though this story is dated September 27th, because for the past months, I have been discussing this phenomenon. And I apparently have the ability, as far as the New York Times, as we sit in their literal, though certainly not metaphorical, shadow, in this case, they are in our metaphorical shadow. Because either I have the ability to report news in the future, except for things like, you know, what the stock market's going to do, or the New York Times is very slow on the uptake. Hundreds of thousands of disillusioned Indians cheer a rural activist on a hunger strike. Israel reels before the largest street demonstrations in history. Enraged young people in Spain and Greece take over public squares across their country. And then this is where it gets a little bit creepy. I challenge anyone to find a similar analysis about people showing up at Tea Party rallies with guns, as in this next paragraph of this New York Times piece. Their complaints range from corruption to lack of affordable housing and joblessness, common grievances all over the world. That's not the part. But from South Asia to the heartland of Europe, now even to Wall Street, there's the brief mention. These protesters share something else: wariness, even contempt toward traditional politicians and the democratic political process they preside over. Let's break down that sentence, shall we? I think there is some validity to saying these people share a wariness, even contempt toward traditional politicians. But this phrase is fairly stunning. And the democratic political process they preside over. Do politicians preside over the democratic process? Aren't they simply one facet of the political process? Isn't the rule of law that which, if anything, presides over the democratic process? Isn't protest, free speech, just as much a part of the democratic process? In fact, in some ways, isn't it more democratic than politicians who necessarily rely on money and capital and influence trading to get to that position? I mean, we are really beginning to see the outlines of the contrast between the elite establishment, whether it's in this country or across the world, and the people, I think, in a way that we haven't seen in ages. And maybe this is the natural fallout from the fall of the Soviet Union and the sort of almost 10-year moratorium that took place in the wake of 9/11, where we don't have the boogeyman and that sort of like comfortable dichotomy between freedom-loving nations and democracies and the evil empire, the Soviet Union. And people are taking a critical eye to those freedom-loving democracies. And the establishment's not appreciating it. Peace goes on to say they're taking to the streets in part because they have little faith in the ballot box. That's weird. I mean, I never saw that construct, the Tea Party movement. Because the Tea Party movement is not a movement at all. The Tea Party movement is simply a subset of the Republican base that was mobilized, or at least sustained, by massive amount of corporate money, by massive amount of establishment money. Do you think those Tea Partiers who are gathering in that Denny's to come up with their own super committee, do you think they have the money and the influence left to their own devices to get CNN coverage for that meeting in the Denny's? Or do you think it's a function of the millions of dollars, the Americans for Prosperity, the Freedom Works, the Heritage Foundation, all of them, these slush funds set up by people like the Koch brothers, the Scaifes? Do you think that's the more reasonable answer there? Economics have been one driving force with growing income inequality, high unemployment, recession-driven cuts in social spending, breeding widespread malaise. But even in India and Israel, where growth remains robust, protesters say they so distrust their country's political class and its pandering to established interest groups that they feel only an assault on the system itself can bring about real change. The one message that I garnered from the people I talked to at Occupy Wall Street is that they find the process, what's going on with our government in terms of its manipulation by moneyed forces, as problematic as anything else. Interestingly, citizens of all ages, but particularly the young, are rejecting conventional structures like parties and trade unions in favor of a less hierarchical, more participatory system modeled in many ways on the culture of the web. I mean, I think that's true of what's going on down in what they now call Liberty Plaza. There's no boss. And I spoke to people who, I mean, you know, some of the interviews really stuck out for me. The medic that we spoke to, you know, we saw this guy walking around with red crosses that he had taped onto his shirt. And you heard the interview if you listened to the podcast yesterday. Many of you downloaded it. And it was fascinating both how he joined the protest, stumbling across it in their march up to Union Square, seeing a woman who was slammed to the ground, helping her, watching two medics get arrested, saying, you know, I was a lifeguard. I've got some CPR training, some basic first aid training. I'm going to do this. And when I asked what the message is, you know, he had a vague notion. I mean, after all, folks, it's called Occupy Wall Street. It's not Occupy Central Park. It's not Occupy the Polo Grounds. It's not Occupy the Denny's. It's Occupy Wall Street. If it had been called Occupy Union Square, I don't think you'd get as many people there. And his response was, you know, they're developing a message. There's a messaging committee. And I get the sense that I share the values here. And so the specifics are not necessary. And we'll get into the critique of the lack of a specific message by the left, the critique of the left in this country in a minute. But Yochi Benkler, director of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University, says you're looking at a generation of 20 and 30-year-olds who are used to self-organizing. They believe life can be more participatory, more decentralized, less dependent on the traditional models of organization, either in the state or the big company. Those were the dominant ways of doing things in the industrial economy. They aren't anymore. Remember that even Barack Obama's campaign started with an online organization that had nothing to do with Barack Obama's campaign. The online support for Barack Obama started and was subsumed, literally bought out, I think, by the Obama campaign. And there were a couple of people there who specifically referenced Obama insofar as, like, we're talking real change. And my sense is it's not a coincidence that you have a lot of 20-year-olds. Now, we spoke to people in their 30s, their 40s, their 50s there. But I don't think it's a coincidence that you have a lot of 20-year-olds there, people who were, in many accounts, brought into the political process by Obama, and I think in some ways became cynical because they had invested so much in President Obama.
It's also, I feel, well, being in my 20s myself, growing up with, growing up with the internet. I mean, we knew, being in our 20s, we knew the time before the internet, and we knew the time with the internet. And with the internet, with Facebook, Twitter, and being at forums and things like that, we're able to, you know, we've realized that we could say stuff and it'll be heard. Like, it's not, we could share information, and actually, if we say something of importance, it'll be found online.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a very different, it's a good point. And the fact of the matter is, you were born with the internet, buddy. were born with the internet.
I remember before the internet.
No, you don't.
I remember before the internet was in everyone's home there.
Okay, yes, maybe the...
I remember the day I got AOL. I remember that day.
You know, how old were you?
I must have been in maybe, maybe fourth, fifth grade?
Yeah, all right.
There was an interesting bit in M Plus One magazine's online section today about how the generational gap has as much to do with the internet as it has to do with who can and can't remember pre-9/11 in a way, that the people who were active enough to... see the difference before and after 9/11 and how speech got cracked down on and how, you know, we were silenced have almost been a little bit more slow to act, and that the young kids not really understanding that things were ever any different sort of have an optimism now that's allowed this to happen.
Right. And, so I don't think it's a coincidence that this is the age of the people that are down there, or at least many of them. And then it goes on to say, frustrated voters are not agitating for a dictator to take over.
Hey, what happened?
What? But they say they do not know where to turn in a time when... Listen to these two sentences. Frustrated voters are not agitating for a dictator to take over. But they say they do not know where to turn at a time when political choices of the Cold War era seem hollow. Now, you could have preceded the sentence, but they say they do not know where to turn at a time when political choices of the Cold War era seem hollow, with any sentence. Frustrated voters don't want to eat bologna sandwiches. But they say they don't know where they want to turn at a time when political choice of the Cold War will seem hollow. Frustrated voters are not agitating for a completely decentralized government. Frustrated voters are not agitating for a feudal system. But a dictator to take over? I mean, you see the gist of what's going on here. The piece is very subtly suggesting that this type of protest is opening the door, is anti-democratic, and opening the door for some type of dictatorship. It's very strange. I don't know if this is some type of subtle warning by the New York Times that these are the periods when fascism takes over. Well, the periods when fascism take over are a function of the failure of the government to provide for the people, not the response of the people for the government failing to provide for them. If the New York Times wants to write a piece that the government has been corrupted by money, that income inequality has provided far too much political power for plutocrats, and then add, this could result in something really, really ugly, as it has in the past. That seems far more legitimate than insinuating, because people are stopped, they're not allowing the shit to rain on them from high above, that could lead to dictatorship. It's just stunning to see the New York Times pushed this narrative, ostensibly covering this worldwide protest movement that is building, but really disparaging it, really saying that this is a warning, that the warning signs should be a function of people saying we've had enough, as opposed to what is causing them to say that. I know I'm getting into a very subtle distinction here, but it's important to know that this is a narrative that you are bound to see more and more. NPR, as of yesterday, the ombudsman was responding to the complaints that NPR, as of yesterday, had not aired, or I should say the 26th, that would have been Monday, had not aired a story on Occupy Wall Street protest. I mean, it's pretty stunning. After Saturday, it didn't air anything. The ombudsman goes on to say, well, apparently the online posts that we've done. NPR, as far as I know, is called National Public Radio. They can post stuff online, but it seems to me that if it's not on their radio, they don't give a shit. The online posts were not enough for Daniel Clay from Atlanta, who wrote, does NPR think this is unimportant? Are you going to wait for someone to die or commit serious violence before you give it the attention it deserves? So the ombudsman asked the news editor, executive editor for news, Dick Meyer, explain your editorial decision. He said, the recent protests on Wall Street did not involve a large number of people. There were thousands on Saturday. Prominent people. As if the notion of celebrity is the only way to drive this. A great disruption. Apparently you need to crack heads to get on NPR. Or an especially clear objective. Why must a protest have a clear objective? And how is this determination made that there is no clear objective?
You know, I'm going to say I was somebody who at the beginning of this, you know, I remember you and I having a conversation about how it irked me, at least from a tactical level, that they didn't have a clear objective. And I've completely turned around on that.
Well, but I mean, all right, from a tactical level, we can get to that. But why should a news agency care about the efficacy of the tactics of a protest? That's not the job of a news agency to determine its value based on its tactical efficacy. The idea that you have hundreds of people at a minimum sleeping out in protest, that level of commitment is not worthy of NPR. Now, they have since, as of last night at 7 p.m., done an all things considered piece, 3-minute piece on the weird goings on down at Occupy Wall Street, which was perhaps one of the most annoying. They're sing-songy. These people have come from around the country. Here's a little snippet of it. I mean, good for them. There is no broader context. Of course, NPR would be the last people to, you know, because last people to actually engage in anything that would in any way impinge upon the establishment. But fortunately, or unfortunately, the New York Times, there are writers who are beginning to pay more attention. Now, there's a new video out that Olbermann played on his show last night. And the audio is not very good on it, or at least it's very hard to decipher. We're going to put it on the blog at majority.fm. The most interesting aspect is from a different angle. It is the video of the woman, the three or four women getting maced. But what you can clearly see in here is a cop, is a bald cop, blue shirt. Remember, it was a white supervising cop named Bologna, I think it is. A cop who incidentally was sued by the ACLU for his behavior at the at the RNC protests. You can hear the bald cop say, and folks, if you have kids listening to the podcast now, cover their ears. This is I'm quoting a cop now. Why'd you fucking mace us? Or something like that, right? What does he say? You fucking maced me. And he's, you know, wiping his eyes. Apparently another cop thanked one of the protesters for warning him. More indication that there was nothing going on that would have given notice to the cops who were looking directly at the woman who was maced. That there was any reason for her to be maced. And more indication that there are some of these cops, and we saw a cop walking amongst the protesters, taking pictures with them, trying to take a picture of Susan Sarandon. She was sporting some massive tats, too. Did you notice that?
Yeah.
And, you know, I think the blue shirt cops are just like, protesters are very nice. They're very calm. They're very organized. And I think there's some supervisors who, either because they have a certain agitation to the way that these people are dressed or they're young or whatever it is, they have a certain predisposition towards these people. Enough so that they should go and mace. You know what should happen to that cop? He should be suspended for a long time. Jim Dwyer in the New York Times points out that the law requires the following label to appear on the cans of pepper spray. The use of this substance or device for any purpose other than self-defense is a criminal offense under the law. And he writes in the video, Deputy Inspector Anthony Bologna looked as if he was spraying cockroaches. He was doing this so indiscriminately.
Someone online said something funny where maybe he's just taking out his frustration because his name is Anthony Bologna. And so all his life he's been made fun of for being Tony Bologna.
Possibly. But maybe those types of cops should be weeded out in some type of psychological exam.
The funny thing about what the official from the NYPD who said that he acted
appropriately.
Yeah. I was reading a New York Times article about the appropriate use of it, and they said how this is the second time where that guy has given false information about Occupy Wall Street. There was someone who was arrested maybe that same day or the march right before that, and they said that someone was arrested for jumping over the barricade,
right.
And then they showed video of the person that they said was jumping over the barricade.
He's clearly pulled over by the cop.
Reaches over and pulls him across the barricade.
All right, so let me get to this story by the Daily News op-ed. Not signed by anybody. Anything that might convince the precious insufferables who have taken over Wall Street that they have had enough of exercising their First Amendment rights to the inconvenience of tens of thousands of people who actually have to work for a living. This bunch ought to get down on their knees and thanks that America's capitalist founding fathers saw it fit to protect the privileges. The privileges. It's not a right anymore. Remember, it was all about the Constitution yesterday, but today it's a privilege of the dumb and obnoxious along with everyone else. If the NYPD has made any tactical error in this episode, it was being too tolerant. Police also closed major intersection to traffic, forcing pedestrians to take the long way around. Further, and this is horrible. This is going to, folks, if you have children, again, please cover their ears. Further, the cops cordoned off the statue of the Wall Street Bull, depriving tourists of up-close and personal inspections.
For those who want an
up-close... Are you effing kidding me?
For those who want an up-close look at the bull's balls, I'm sorry, you're going to have to defer
Give
to another day.
Give me a break here. Unbelievable. Amid arrest, that senior officer was photographed applying pepper spray in a video that is being held up as evidence of a human rights violation, worthy of a trial at the International Criminal Court. It is conceivable that he could have kept his spray holstered. Then again, he was surrounded by chaos. No, in fact, he was not surrounded by chaos because there was a huge orange netting between him and all the protesters. And by all the protesters, I mean those half dozen women that were corralled. The right to free speech comes with responsibilities. It does not encompass a right to do just whatever you want, whenever you want, as these juveniles may one day learn. Now, Glenn Greenwald has a great piece on what's behind the scorn for these protests. He said, it's the nature of protests that take place outside of approved channels, an inevitable byproduct of disruptive dissent. Those who are most vested in safeguarding and legitimizing establishment prerogatives, which by definition includes establishment media outlets, are going to be hostile to those challenges. As the virtually universal disdain in these same circles for WikiLeaks, and before that, the Iraq war protest demonstrated, the more effectively adversarial it is, the more establishment hostility it's going to provoke. Most of the scornful criticism have come from Democratic partisans who, like the politicians to whom they devote their fealty, feign populist opposition to Wall Street for political gain. A significant aspect of this progressive disdain is grounded in the belief that the only valid form of political activism is support for Democratic Party candidates and a corresponding desire to undermine anything that distracts from that goal. Indeed, the loyalists of both parties have an interest in marginalizing anything that might serve as a vehicle for activism outside the fealty to one of two parties. I can tell you, the best instrument, in my estimation, to get the Democratic Party to do anything, or I should say one of, I think there's value in taking over local Democratic Party apparatus. But I also think protests like this are extraordinarily helpful. The very idea that one can effectively battle Wall Street's corruption and control by working for the Democratic Party is absurd on its face. And I think that's a fairly valid point. I'm not sure it's mutually exclusive. But certainly if you exclusively work on behalf of the Democratic Party as the only means in which to deal with the corruption that emanates from Wall Street, I think you're going to be out of luck. Much of this progressive criticism consists of relatively, ostensibly well-intentioned tactical and organizational critiques of the protest. There wasn't a clear, unified message. It lacked a coherent media strategy. The neo-hippie participants were too off-putting to middle America. The resulting police brutality overwhelmed the message, et cetera, et cetera. That's the high-minded form from which most progressive scorn for the protest took. It's just not professionally organized or effective. Some of these critiques are ludicrous. Does anyone really not know what the basic message of the protest? I think it's fairly self-evident. Again, it's called Occupy Wall Street, not Occupy Central Park, not Occupy the Natural Museum of History, not Occupy Union Station. I guess which would be in D.C. or Worcester, Massachusetts. Dismissing these incipient protests because they lack a fully developed, sophisticated professionalization is akin to pronouncing a three-year-old child worthless because he can't read Schopenhauer. I even think that analogy is wrong. I actually think there is value in just the fact that they are exemplifying that there is anger. Anger that is so deep that people are willing to put their physical well-being in peril, sleeping out on the streets, risking pepper spray or dislocated shoulders or a beating from a cop or getting arrested or quitting their jobs or cutting back on their freelance work. What that shows and what the message is that there is commitment to the anger. And the idea that they are not professionally organized should be, in fact, a value added, as the corporatists would say, to their protests. They are not funded by the Koch brothers, the AFP. They're not funded by these large institutional organizations. In fact, it's only today. And last night, some of the protesters went and joined a protest by the postal workers. We've talked about what's going on with the post office on this program in the past. But I believe today there is now local union support that's showing up. And perhaps some national unions showing up. They are drawing people to them. despite the fact that they don't have a sophisticated, although it is certainly becoming more sophisticated, media center that is feeding stories to the media. It's a great piece. You should go on to read the whole thing. But it's clear that we see both scorn from the professional media managers on the left, scorn from the establishment media in general, and certainly more intimidation tactics to cause a certain amount of pain for those people who are willing to do this. Naomi Klein posts a letter, an open letter from Arun Gupta. He is the editor of The Independent. She says, if I were in New York, she's based in, she's in Canada, I would certainly be spending time at the Wall Street Occupation. I urge those of you who live in the area to go in person to Liberty Park and check it out. Keep in mind, any attempt to create a genuinely open space to share political ideas is necessarily going to be chaotic and at times embarrassing. Yes. Yes, there are people down there who are dressed funny or playing drums, or at least, you know, I'm a very conservative dresser. If it's not checked, if there's not a check pattern, 9 times out of 10, I won't wear it. Even when I go on, some of these, news shows, I get, "Wow, you dress like a Republican." I grew up in Worcester. There was one place where I bought my clothes. That was it. Shacks, I think it was called. But she writes, but Gupta's point is a crucial one. This is not the time to be looking for ways to dismiss a nascent movement against the power of capital, but to do the opposite, to find ways to embrace it, support it, and help it grow to its enormous potential. With so much at stake, cynicism is a luxury we simply cannot afford. And believe me, I am a cynical guy. But Gupta goes on to write, to be fair, the scene in Liberty Plaza seems messy and chaotic, but it's also a laboratory of possibility, and that's the beauty of democracy. As opposed to our monoculture world, where political life is flipping a lever every 4 years, social life is being a consumer and economic life is being a timid cog, the Wall Street Occupation is creating a polyculture of ideas, expression, and art. Yet while many people support the occupation, they hesitate to fully join in and are quick to offer criticism. It's clear that the biggest obstacles to building a powerful movement are not the police or capital. It's our own cynicism and despair. Hey, look, do I think it would help if every person down there was wearing a sport coat and a collared shirt and a tie? Yeah, probably. But I also think that if someone was inclined to wear that, they would be much less inclined to sleep out every night. Because, A, you'd ruined it after a couple of days and it would look like crap. But, B, that's just not the way people roll. From my perspective, I'm a clean for Gene guy. That's why I dress like I do when I go on. Part of it is also probably just sort of my performance art background. I want to fuck with people's expectations. I am much more conscious of the average person having done, been an actor and a performer for years, of being sensitive to audience preconception. And frankly, I don't care. Look at the way I dress. It's not a mode of self-expression for me. My mode of self-expression is actually to go on and talk for an hour and a half every day and to get into other outlets to talk. Not everybody has those faculties. I barely have those faculties. But I have a healthy dose of denial to the extent that I have limitations in that respect. So, yes, it would be wonderful if everybody down there dressed like Tucker Carlson and walked around And but the same reasons why many of those people don't is the same reason why it exists. It's very easy to be cynical about it. It's much harder to find those elements down there that impress you, that you can relate to, that can inspire you. And that's the reason basically why I went down there, was to offer a bunch of different voices, some of whom may make sense to you, some of them won't. But hopefully one or two or three or four or more of those people will have said something that will resonate with you and will inspire you to go out, whether it's in Boston or Chicago or LA, or whether you live in New York, or whether you do it in some fashion online, whether you pass on a video, whether you make a defense of these people to your friends, but it'll in some way get you involved in it. Because I can assure you, if it grows, the benefits will also grow exponentially. They may or may not be there in 3 weeks, in 3 months, in 3 years. Nothing could directly come out of this except for a greater awareness that there is a sense of injustice, except for the next movement that comes out of it. You know, I've used this analogy before. Air America could not have existed but for a crazy person. But it also very well may have sealed its fate that it was founded by a crazy person who was a con man. But many good things came out of Air America. And so I hope that people will not be cynical about what's going on down there and will go down and check it out. It's definitely worth seeing. All right, folks. Now on to the better half of the show. Piece by Ryan Grimm on the Super Committee. Going over basically what we had talked about a week or two ago on this program. This is good news. Deaths from cantaloupe listeria rise. Those EPA rumors, comically wrong. Folks, I know some of you are too cheap to become members. I know you're too lazy. I know you won't do it. I want you to do it anyways, but regardless how cheap and lazy you are, go over to podcastawards.com. Nominate us. You have one more day to do it. One more day. The nominations close on Friday. You have one more day to do this. Nominate this show for, what is it, political news, Matt?
Yep, that's it.
Political news. Because at the very least, you can help spread the word of this show, and maybe those people will become members. You cheapy. You welfare podcasters getting out of your fancy Cadillacs. And listen, I want to repeat this. If you cannot afford a membership, email me at majorityreporters@gmail.com and we will work something out. No one will not get the full access to the program if they want it and can't afford it. I promise you. We have a lot of new listeners, and I want to encourage you, if you want the full access, you want full access to the show, just email me, majorityreporters@gmail.com. Of course, you can buy your Just Coffee from the justcoffee.coop. Co-op business owned by its employees. Fair trade coffee, organic coffee, chocolate and tea, 10% discount with the coupon code MAJORITY. You buy crap through Amazon, buy it through our link so at least we get a kickback. You can also donate your Twitter account or Facebook account at donateyouraccount.com/MajorityFM.
Citizen Radio has greatly taken the lead from us on that.
Oh, really? Because they keep hyping it. We'll talk about this tomorrow. They're mocking our audience more. We're going to get some youth out. All right, folks. back live on Friday, but there'll be a show tomorrow. Join me in the better half of the show coming up right now.